Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and it's another episode of Fun Ideas Podcasts. Today we have a special guest who worked with Jim Henson and the Muppets, and he wrote a book that I have in my background here, but I'll hold it up too, called Sam and Friends, the story of Jim Henson's first television show. If I hold it in front of my face, it should show up without disappearing too much. And his name is Greg Shimin. How are you?
I'm good. Good to talk to you.
Where do you hail from?
Well, I was born in the Bronx, New York, and I grew up in New Jersey from the age of 5, and then I moved back to Manhattan after a couple years after college. So I'm an East Coast person.
Is that where you are now in Manhattan?
I am talking to you deep within the island of Manhattan.
Very cool. I am on the opposite
And in
coast. I grew up in California, but I'm currently in Springfield, Oregon. So, it's kind of
Oh.
set. And I have been a Muppets fan probably since birth. which I'm sure a lot of people have said, but the interesting thing was, and I'll hold up a different book, my first exposure was Ed Sullivan and Sesame Street. So I didn't know that Henson did anything prior to Ed Sullivan show. Maybe other shows like it, but it was this book, which I hopefully can hold up, called The Art of the Muppets, that came out about 1980. Oops, it's disappearing now. And they had this page in here with Yorick, and it talked about Sam and Friends. And I said, what the heck is that? So, over the years, I've seen little bits and pieces of it and stuff like that. So I kind of got familiar with what it was, but never really knew the whole story behind it. And so I'm thanking you that you finally kind of put as best as you could, because I know there's a lot of missing episodes and things like that. The virtually complete story of Sam and Friends and what it was all about and how did it start and all that stuff. So I appreciate that. So I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Well, I'm very glad.
So I know you work for Jim Henson, and so I guess tell me a little bit about yourself and how you ended up working for him at least a few years.
Well, I was always interested in writing. I went to school at Northwestern University, and I planned on pursuing a writing future. And then I happened to see a documentary on Jim Henson. I had been a Muppet fan, when I was younger, because I was in that first group of Sesame Street students when I was the show premiered in 1969 when I was 3 years old. So I was right at the beginning of that. And then when the Muppet Show came on, I was about 10. So I was a big fan. I would go to the library, look up everything I could about Jim Henson, and then sort of, I was like, well, that was good. And then I went into high school and college. And then when I was in college, I saw a documentary about Jim Henson just when I was trying to figure out what to do over the summer for an internship. And so it was between junior and senior year, and a lot of my friends were applying for various internships. And I saw this documentary and I said, gee, I've always been a fan of the Muppets, Jim Henson. Maybe I can get an internship. And I called up, I dialed information. This is the era that it was. We didn't have World Wide Web or Google. And I got the number for Henson Associates in New York, and I called and I got an appointment to come in over the spring break and interview for an internship. And that's how I started. So I went from intern to part-time employee over my breaks, and then I was hired for the public relations department when I graduated, and then eventually moved over to writing, and spent 14 years at the company and got to know Jim Henson a little bit and work with him for a couple of years before he passed away.
And I assume during that time you worked with all the other Muppet regulars like
Oh
Frank
yeah,
Oz and Jerry Nelson and all the different people.
absolutely. I loved working with Frank, and who was kind enough to write the foreword for my book. We would spend most of the time we worked together, we were doing the morning talk shows or various Miss Piggy appearances, and I would work on the material for him for those appearances. So I think I spent most of the time I spent with Frank like at 5 a.m. or at the Today Show.
So what would you prepare, like notes for him and stuff, so he wouldn't
Well, we found that people, the audience expects more entertainment from a Muppet appearance on these talk shows than a regular talk show appearance. So, what if a human being goes on a talk show, they do a pre-interview with producers. So when the Muppets went on the talk shows in that period of time, I would do the pre-interview with the producers, and there was a little bit of a Henson team that would figure out what we would do, what this bit would be, and what would Miss Piggy wear, and did the shop need to make anything new for props? And we would generate sort of a bit, and it would be scripted, but then Frank would come in and sort of deconstruct it down to its essentials, because he didn't want to, he liked to be a little more spontaneous. So he would take my script and he would take out the jokes that he wanted to hit and write them on a little 3x5 card, which he would then tape to his knee. So he knew that if so and so said this cue line, he had a joke, and he had a joke. And he would try and distill my 4 or 5 page script into this 3x5 card, so he could preserve the sort of the essence of the routine without having to feel like he had to do a script word for word, which he really didn't like doing in those live appearances, just because he wanted to feed off of the spontaneity of the day.
Almost sounds like how Larry David does Curb Your Enthusiasm, or
Yeah, it's
Christopher
not
Guest
unlike
does
that.
his films. It's like you have a basic idea, but then
And some of the shows really didn't want that. Some of the shows, they felt that their star, and I won't mention names, but it's like, well, we want this person to know exactly what's happening, and Frank, felt the opposite way. It's like he wanted to keep people on their toes, and he felt that a Muppet appearance on television is best if no one knows what's going to happen next. And some of the producers are a little fearful for their jobs, and they didn't want to get into that situation.
Although I admit, as a fan, I like the more spontaneous and less scripted, the better,
Exactly, and that's the
even if it
goal.
was, is if I didn't I if I couldn't tell and they were just clowning around as Muppets with the host or whatever, I love that.
Right, and our goal with Frank is to have him feel comfortable that he didn't feel he was going out there without any material, but he was armed with some one-liners. He was armed with some jokes and a backstory, and he wanted to know what the situation was, more than anything. Has Piggy been partying the night before and is really tired, or is Piggy annoyed at something that Today Show people did? Or is she still in the middle of a fight with Piggy or her hairstylist? I mean, he wanted to have a starting point more than anything else.
But it sounds like both Jim and Frank, and probably all the others, were pretty, witty, as it were, that even if they didn't have a joke at the ready, they might come up with something
Oh, absolutely. And
spontaneously there too.
there would be times where Frank would come back having, he would come up with something, that wasn't in the script, that just sailed. And then there are times where he'd come after an appearance and he said, "Oh, I should have used this line, And the other thing that was funny about Frank is that if he used a line while we did a rehearsal, he didn't want to use it again for the show because he knew the crew wouldn't laugh at it because they had heard it before. And it's like, well, we
Interesting.
got 12 people here, but we have like a million people watching at home who haven't heard it. But he wanted to get a reaction, and he felt that he couldn't get, if the crew had heard a joke, he didn't want to use it again because he wouldn't get that same reaction.
Now, as apprentice, and during all those years, what was this all you did, or did you do other assignments as needed,
Oh
or
yeah.
even puppeteering? Did you even do that?
I did puppeteering once or twice, but yeah, we did a It was right after Jim passed away, and they did a the Muppets Celebrate Jim Henson. So it was a situation where most everyone that worked for the company, if you had any ability to raise a puppet over your hand, you were called into service, because the last scene in this show was Kermit making his return, with Steve Whitmire performing it, and everybody gathered as that happened. So it was a set that was built in this tiny carriage house studio in New York, but it was built to kind of echo the Muppet Show. This was like a TV studio setting, but there was a balcony up at the top, so it was formatted in a very similar way. So I was up in the balcony doing Waldorf, and Duncan Kenworthy, well-known producer, was next to me doing Statler, and Bill Prady, who went on to do The Big Bang Theory, was next to him, and Cheryl Henson was next to. So we were not the A-level puppeteers, but we were up on ladders to sort of fill in the frame. So that was my main puppetry experience. I did a couple little things here and there, but
Well, it sounds like they did similar things probably prior to your tenure, like at the end of the Muppet movie, they have a
Oh
big puppet cast there, or Muppet
yeah.
cast,
It was sort of referred to within the, we called them all hands on deck situations, literally. So yeah, that was, so I did do a little bit though, but the kind of job that I had when I became staff writer, originally the position was called associate creative director. But it was a wonderful job because it was all kinds of creative stuff, anything that had a written word element. So I wrote tags for merchandise, and I wrote meeting films, industrials, and I wrote CD-ROM and video games. I wrote, if characters had to do, greetings for corporate sponsors. And and of course interviews for the for print interviews, as well as television. So it was every day I came into work, I got to do something different.
Now, did you get to touch every aspect? Now, I don't mean every role, but I mean every series or anything that they worked on, any movie, Sesame Street and everything.
Well, Sesame Street I did a little bit, but Sesame Street operated out of the what was then called a Children's Television Workshop, now Sesame Workshop. So they had their own team. I did like one or two Sesame things over the years, but I did some Fraggle Rock. I did Fraggle Rock book and tape, and story for a publisher, Fraggle Rock stories for publishing. I wrote the Farscape trading cards. So yeah, it was across, all manner of the character groups.
Before we get into your book, so why did you leave? I mean, was there better opportunities elsewhere,
No,
or
it
just
was actually, it
tired?
was not, no, it was not my choice. The company went through some changes in ownership, and the Henson family had sold it to a German company, and the German company, EMTV, then suffered a lot of financial problems. And they, while it was in the hands of the German company, they downsized considerably. So a lot of people left the company at that time. And I continued to be involved with the Jim Henson legacy. Jane Henson, around that time, started a nonprofit organization. Actually, she started it before then, but it was becoming more important at this time because she felt that while these individual companies that were going to be owning the various characters would keep the characters going, she wanted to make sure that Jim's name was associated with the various works that he had done. So she invited me to join the board of trustees of this nonprofit. So I stayed involved with the Henson family, and occasionally did some work for the Henson company, and then also did some work for Disney once the Henson family they rebought the company later on, and then they sold part of it to Disney. So I did some work for Disney. I did some work for Henson, and I. Now the president of the Jim Henson Legacy. So that's a volunteer position, which I'm very proud to be a part of. And but I still do a little bit of stuff here and there.
Now, what does that position entail, the being head of the legacy?
Well, it basically involves keeping Jim's name alive by doing events, exhibitions, and we worked with the Henson family for them. They made donations to the Center for Puppetry Arts and the Museum of the Moving Image. And each of those organizations have dedicated Jim Henson exhibitions. So the legacy works with them to help create programming around that. And then we also work with the Smithsonian. The Henson family gave the Smithsonian the original Sam and Friends characters and a couple dozen more Henson characters from different eras. So we work with various entities to do programming. You know, a big thing is we do monthly screenings at the Museum of the Moving Image, and we help promote presentations at the Center for Puppetry Arts. So now it's mostly supporting these partners. Before those exhibits existed, we worked with the Smithsonian to do a traveling exhibit, and we had a touring screening series that we would do all over the world. And that's sort of you know, it was a it's a very unique situation because the Jim Henson legacy being a nonprofit, the various partners, the other the companies that own these copyrights work with us, so we can present all of these things under Jim Henson's name. We did a few years back, we did a 3 week long event in New Zealand that was run by Nick Marshall and the Square Eyes Foundation in New Zealand. And they brought us to Melbourne, where we did 3 weeks of screenings, workshops, events, and then all culminated with a 4 day sold out live concert. It was hosted and directed by Brett McKenzie, and I wrote the script for it. And we had Muppets from all the different character groups. So we had Big Bird, and we had Fozzie, and we had Piggy, and we had Red Fraggle, and we had the symphony played a orchestral suite from Dark Crystal. And all of that was presented under the Jim Henson name. It was the Jim Henson Retrospectacle in Concert. And all of the partners allowed all of these different characters to appear in this one show. And there were, you know, rules around that, that they all, you know, couldn't interact until we had our big finale at the end. But, you know, it's important to keep Jim's name connected to all of this.
I mean, this might be a dumb question, but I mean, saying that that was in New Zealand, I guess Muppets are known the world over. You don't ever have to explain what they are,
The
typically.
Muppets are known the world over, but there are certain places where, you know, that they do, they're more known, places like New Zealand, Australia, and England, that are English-speaking countries, because those shows, those versions of the shows were not dubbed. So when we go over there to bring the performers, they're hearing them the way they always heard them. You know, it would be harder for us to do a concert like that in Spain, you know, where they're used to hearing different voices for the characters. So you'd almost have to have like those voices that looped it also involved in this show somehow. But yeah, the Muppets are known around the world. And lately, Disney has sort of been undergoing this unification program, for lack of a better word, because the Muppets used to have different names all over the place. Like,
Never thought
in
about that, but yeah.
France, Kermit was a René. And then Disney, you know, a few years ago said, well, that doesn't really make sense. Let's try. And so it was confusing to the people who grew up with a René to all of a sudden, oh, now he's Kermit, you know. But they figured, you know, if we're gonna, you know, easier, we're if we're gonna sell toys and stuff, we're gonna have to make different names all over the place. And so they've been working, you know, so now the Muppet names are pretty much what they are
Makes
all over the
sense.
world.
Now, the Sam and Friends book, is that your second book? Because I know you did a Muppets character encyclopedia as well, so.
Yeah, but I, you know, it depends on if how you want to count the cookbook I wrote with Miss Piggy.
Oh, I forgot about
Because
that.
I don't really, you know, I am credited with Alice and Inches as, as people who we helped Miss Piggy. Yeah, it's sort of the second major book, but if you
Okay.
want to count Miss Piggy, it's the third. And then I've written a couple of like little children's books and stuff,
Okay.
but I don't
Now,
really count
let's talk
those.
about the character encyclopedia first, and then we'll get into Sam and Friends. It is just, I assume because of the legacy or even just working there, you had access to information. Was that readily available, or did they keep bad records or bad archives, or what was their situation when putting together
Well,
such a
it's
book?
the Henson Archives. They have a terrific archive because Karen Falk runs that organization. But if it's hard as an archivist to take care of something if it doesn't exist first. So some of these characters that I had to write about exist, they only appeared in one episode of The Muppet Show. So there's like a script. And some of them have a drawing, but there's not really a lot of backstory on some of these characters. So I had to sort of come up with things. I worked with Jim Lewis, who I'd worked with for many years at the Henson Company. He was sort of the editorial guy that Disney had on staff at the time. And he would look at and we'd go back and forth, and I'd write something and send it to Jim. And we would just try and put in as many little things that would make us laugh. Dr. Strangepork, I said, well, he's from Hamburg, Germany, because he's a pig. And Jim wrote back and said, no, make it Hamelburg, because that's where Hogan's Heroes took place. So, we would go back and forth and just try and put in things. We knew that people wouldn't notice. This was a this book was an official Disney publication through DK Publishing. So we had very strict guidelines of what we could or couldn't do. So we had to sort of work within that. They didn't want any real world references, in terms of who was building the puppets or who was performing the puppets. This had to work entirely within the world of the Muppets. But we tried to work in things. We tried to mention some of the names of workshop people, in the thing by saying, oh, it's th this is Buchholz's, something or other. And Fred Buchholz was a guy who worked at the workshop, doing special effects and stuff. So I think I worked him into the men in into Gonzo's description somehow, talking about where he bought things or something. So it was more about trying to come up with fun things than, we did as much research as we could, but some of these characters just didn't have a lot of backstory.
Just curious about that. I mean, and I was asking about the archives. If there's a Muppet, you mentioned that there are some that just appeared once. If there's a Muppet that just appeared once, what happens to it after it's used? Do they discard it, or they just put it in a drawer somewhere? What happens?
All of the above. Sometimes they keep them,
Okay.
and sometimes a Muppet that appears once is built from what they call a whatnot, or if on Sesame Street it would be an anything Muppet,
Right. Okay.
which is sort of a bare face thing, and they construct a creature, a Muppet, over it, and then when it's done, they just take the stuff off. It's all applied with
Okay.
pins or double stick tape, and then they just take it, and it's ready to be something else the next week.
Ruining the illusions here, folks. Anyway,
Yeah.
but that's, I'm curious,
No,
because
but some of these characters did start like that. So it's not like they would be thrown away, but they would
okay.
emerge as something else the next week.
And then other things I remember seeing over the years, like in the earliest years of Sesame Street, a lot of the Muppets were more like the monster ones, like Grover, were more gray or kind of a greenish hue. And then later they became bright blue and things like that. So did the older ones get discarded or used for other things? And, when they
Well,
decided to do that, or?
they would only get discarded if they really felt started falling apart. You know, these puppets were not really designed to last forever, but the original puppet that became Grover is at the Smithsonian now. You know, so we would save them, and once they become incapable of being performed, we would find a home for them, or they would, you know, some would get destroyed just because, you know, Henson's were very careful about not letting Muppets out into the open market. But yeah, that's, you know, some. And your interest. What's interesting also about the faded colors and stuff. Some of it is the puppets. Also, some of it is the television technology. You know, at the beginning, Sesame Street and you know, Ed Sullivan Show didn't have the best. You know, the most. You know, it was state of the art at the time in terms of the color television technology, but certain colors didn't look great in that early color television stuff. That's why some of these puppets evolved over years. Like Orange Oscar, in the first iteration of Oscar the Grouch, he was orange, and I don't think he looked great on television, orange. And I think that they decided that green would look better, and they turned him to green.
Yeah, I never really knew why they changed it, but yeah, I remember that change. And so, but you know, like I said, I remember Kermit changed a few times over the years. In fact, you know, now going into the book, I mean, Kermit wasn't really supposed to officially be a frog originally, correct?
He was none of the characters early on in Sam and Friends were specifically any individual, actual, real creature. I think Jim wanted to keep them as abstract creatures that could turn into anything. And then over time, they started referring to Kermit as a lizard. You know, some scripts called him a tree lizard, and you know, some did men, you know, say that he was, you know, he was related to a frog or is from a frog family, and he wasn't really a frog until later on.
And then you know, we were talking about colors there. It's like, didn't I remember reading in your book that there is a little bit of difficulty to a certain extent as far as transitioning from black and white to color over the years with some of the Muppets and
Yeah, because Jim started out in black and white, and he liked working in black and white. And then he had to sort of, you know, they made the transition to color, and you know, the original characters were still around, and you know, I think he had to then think about creating new characters that would look good in both black and white and color. Which then, you know, creates just another hassle. It's not just about making a puppet that's going to look good in one, but they have to look good. At that time, it was called compatible color. It was a color transmission that was compatible with black and white sets. So it was something he had to worry about.
Now, I mean, I know the obvious reason, which is the reason I snapped this book up, but why Sam and Friends? Why not just do a book about all the Muppets like have been done before? What intrigued you about this particular series to cover it more in depth?
Well, and those are the two words, in depth, and that's really what made it really attractive to me. Brian J. Jones was a terrific author, and Brian, if you're watching or listening, I'm looking forward to your next book. Brian J. Jones wrote an amazing biography of Jim Henson, but because it had to cover an entire career, he couldn't go deep into detail in any one thing. I remember I sent him manuscript for my book, and he was so excited that I was able to go into detail, stuff that he actually had in his first draft. His editor made him take out because it's like, you know, you don't need to go into that much detail when you're covering a career. You know, he had to get it down to, you know, whatever page count he had to get it down to. Since my book essentially covers about 7 or 8 years of Jim Henson's career, I was able to really concentrate on those years, on that period, and go into as much detail as I wanted to. And I had no idea I'd be able to get nearly 600 pages out of this because, you know, when I first started at Henson, there was very little in terms of Sam and Friends. And I remember I was the one who found the folder in the warehouse that had the surviving Sam and Friends scripts. And, you know, we kept on discovering more and more. And it was always it's still not enough to do a book. And then the Henson Archives found reel-to-reel tapes that Jim had started making of the audio of Sam and Friends, more than 400 episodes. So at that point, it's like, oh, well, now there may be enough. So just it's so exciting to me. And I think one of the reasons that I wanted to do this is that I started working at the Henson Company when I was in college. And Jim Henson started doing Sam and Friends when he was in college. And I started thinking, gee, you know, I really can relate to this guy. And I also started thinking, what am I doing with my life? You know, this guy had his own TV show by then. But I thought that doing a book like this would not only be able to tell Jim Henson's story and Jane Henson's story. Jane always went out of her way to avoid taking any credit for Sam and Friends, but I wanted to give her what she deserved. But I also thought it would be inspiring to kids who are either in college or just out of college to tell a story about someone who, you know, just took some fabric and you know, paper and cloth and tape and put together something and without all of the technology that we have nowadays. You know, now anybody can make their own Sam and Friends. You know, anybody can make their own TV show, you know, and basically using their phone. Yeah, and they can post it on YouTube. And you know, this was just a whole other era where you had to go to a TV studio and get someone to be willing to put you on television. So I thought that this was an inspiring story for young artists. All of those things really led me to doing this book.
Now, what was Jim doing right prior to this? I mean, he didn't just suddenly say, I'm going to do puppets. You know, he's like he always had an interest in it, right? Yeah.
No, he
Really?
was in high school. He was not particularly interested in puppets at all, but he was interested in television. And a local television station wanted to do a show with puppets as a part of it, but they wanted kids to do everything on this show. It was a sort of a takeoff on a CBS morning news show that was running at the time, and Bill Baird had a puppet segment. So they were like, well, we'll have kids do everything on this show, and then we'll have a kid puppeteer. So Jim auditioned for that spot, not because he knew how to do puppets, but because he wanted to see what a television studio looked like. He wanted to work in a TV studio. So he went to the library, got library books, taught himself how to build puppets, and him and his friend built puppets, and they went and they got this gig, and it lasted just a few weeks because of legal issues that I go into in the book. But that's why, you know, and that started everything. And someone at that station thought he was really good and recommended him to another station once this show had gone off the air. And he went and started doing puppets on that station. That led to Sam and Friends.
Now, was he trying to gear any of his work, let's say pre-Sesame Street, because obviously that one is geared towards children, but did he try to gear it to any particular audience, or was he just trying to entertain himself, or what was the deal
I
with,
think it's mostly entertaining himself. You know, you look at this type of stuff when he first started, he was doing lip syncs to a lot of comedy recordings and other musical standards, and a lot of stuff that he enjoyed. Things that Stan Freberg, he was a fan of Stan Freberg. He liked Pogo, a comic strip, so he did songs from Pogo. So a lot of this was stuff that he liked, but he was a pretty regular guy who was, you know, he was a college age guy, and a lot of people liked this stuff. He was going to University of Maryland, and I think a lot of people resonated with his sense of humor. And Jim was born in Mississippi. He grew up in Maryland, so he had, a fun sense of humor that he developed over the years. It was fed by a lot of these things that he listened to. He begged his family to get a television set early on, as soon as they were available. So he would be watching things like Ernie Kovacs, he loved comic strips. So all of this fed in to it. But I think that he was essentially creating stuff that he liked doing.
Right. Kind of interesting. This is coming from seeing the documentary about Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, that even though he's a little bit older and he was going through the seminary and things like that, he had kind of a similar epiphany, as it were, I guess, that he, worked with puppets and wanted to work in television, and he thought that that would be a good way to communicate and stuff like that. Did Jim have that part of him too, that he wanted to communicate? I mean, what did he have any ultimate goals in these days of the Salmon Friends, that, like, could he have foreseen the Muppet Show or Muppet movies or Dark Crystal or anything more advanced like that? Or what was his
At the
ultimate
very
goal?
beginning, I don't think so. I think at the
Okay.
very beginning, his goal was to, have fun and make a little extra money while he was in school. It was a, a part-time job, and he also worked in the scene shop at the television studio, so he was, enjoying that. And it was in 1958, he took a trip with a friend of his, Joe Irwin, to Europe, and he started seeing the puppetry that was being done in Europe. And while puppets in America at that time were really regarded as a children's medium, in Europe and they were it had a long, rich history all throughout the rest of the world, Europe, Asia. And he was able to see these puppetry artists working, and he came back, with the concept that this could be something he could do as a career. And at that point, he did everything. He incorporated. He and Jane started Muppets Incorporated. He had 60%. She had 40%. They had decided to get married, and they started really taking this more seriously as a business. And that's sort of where and I think that a lot of the stuff that he was doing sort of evolved over time. But there were things that he did on Salmon Friends that got redone on The Muppet Show decades later. It was a very interesting path he took, but he sort of started at that point. 1958 is when he really said, hey, this could be something.
Then also in the book, you cover, like, the many advertisements that he did for, like, Wilkins Coffee and SK Meats, I guess.
SK, yep. Schluterberg and Kirtle and SK.
Did they come to him, or did he pursue that? How did those come?
The way we understand it, that they came to him, that SK, we don't know exactly how, but somehow that the TV station and the ad agency for SK sort of made that connection, and they became sponsors of Salmon Friends. And the coffee company, which was a regionally run coffee company, Wilkins, the owner, John Wilkins, saw Jim on one of the network variety shows that they had started doing, and he started to, hey, this could work to sell my coffee. And he got his ad agency to get in touch with Jim, and that really was an amazing thing, because Jim was able to create these very brief 8-second commercials and do them all over the country for different products, because this was a regional brand. So you could do these same, you could refilm a commercial for all of these different brands. In addition to Wilkins Coffee, you could do Frank's Nectar and Calso Water and Martinson's Coffee, and you know, it was all over the country.
I guess remember seeing well, this might be later. Was it shoot, I can't remember. It had a dragon in it.
Oh, LaCroix.
LaCroix,
LaCroix.
yeah, that's what
Yep.
I was thinking Chun King, and I go, it's not Chun King. Yeah, LaCroix. Was that the same situation there? You know, did they come to
No, that
him
was
or?
done specifically. That was just a creature, a character that was built specifically for LaCroix. They wanted a
Okay.
fire-breathing dragon,
I see.
so
Okay.
Jim built a fire-breathing dragon.
And then you say the Sam and Friends lasted roughly 6.5 years. Does that count
Around seven years or so.
the does that count the local Washington D.C. stuff and the NBC stuff, everything, or is that?
Well, Sam and Friends really wasn't on nationally.
Okay.
They would take the characters nationally to do the Tonight Show or the Today Show,
Okay.
but Sam and Friends itself started in 1955 and ended in 1961. And at that point, after that, about a year after that, Jim and Jane moved up to New York and started doing more of the variety shows. And they did the Jimmy Dean Show and the Today Show, and they eventually did the Ed Sullivan Show and a lot of Tonight Show appearances through the years. And all while doing commercials. And that was also when Jim was doing his experimental film era. He directed a short film called Timepiece that got nominated for an Oscar in 1965.
I don't think I'm aware of that. I'll have to
Yeah,
research
it's an amazing
that.
film. Yeah.
But I did know, later on Sesame Street, of course, he did film work with, the numbers, the various numbers, as it were,
Yeah,
the
and throughout the whole 60s, Jim really he thought of himself as a filmmaker, but he would do the Muppet stuff to pay for the filmmaking. But once Sesame Street came along and became such a hit and took up so much of the time, he was no longer really able to be a filmmaker anymore. He sort of put all of the time towards Muppets, and then that led to eventually The Muppet Show.
Now, why the move at that point, 1961? Was it because he's starting a family and everything, or?
No, I think they at that time New York City was really the nexus of live television, for not filmed television, but sort of variety show television and commercials. So he knew that he wanted to do things on a national basis. He really needed to be where all of this was happening, and they would go up to New York frequently to do commercial projects and variety shows and stuff. So I think that they figured that New York was the logical next step to take things to the next level.
And I guess Ed Sullivan was probably a good proponent for him from the
He had,
standpoint as later he had Topo Gigio, he liked that type of
yeah, and he
stuff.
ended up doing like 25 appearances on the Sullivan Show. And Ed Sullivan also gave him an hour of his show to
Oh,
do
yeah.
the Great Santa Claus Switch. It was sort of Jim's first big 1 hour special. And it was, Ed Sullivan was real generous with his, didn't always get Jim's name right when he introduced him, but here's Jim Jensen, bring out the Muppets.
Yes.
But he was a great proponent of Jim's work and helped them a great deal.
Now, I know we're going beyond the scope of the book, but I'm just curious out of my own interests. I know that during the 70s, when he was doing Sesame Street and before the Muppet Show, they did like Hey Cinderella and the Frog Prince, something like that, Princess and the Frog, and Bremen Town Musicians, different
Muppet
specials like
Musicians of
that.
Bremen, yeah.
Who funded those? I mean, how did those come about? Was that just purely from Sesame Street money, or did networks come
No,
after them, or?
they had sponsors. I think some of them were like Reynolds Aluminum, I think, was involved as a sponsor. They would come out. These shows were investments from these various sponsors, and I don't think Jim was putting his own money into it, and I don't think he re really had as that much money to put into it at that point. But I think they would get sponsors. These were all that three those specials, which we sort of collectively referred to as the Tales from Muppet Land, they were syndicated specials, so they aired all over the country on different syndicated specials, but they were produced by a sponsor, and I think it was Reynolds. Maybe, I don't know if it was on all three, but I think they were involved. And so they would say, "Here's a hunk of money, make this show," and you know, it gets distributed.
So yeah, and it seemed like, and if memory serves, that the first time, or maybe the only time, Henson like ponied up his own money might have been Dark Crystal, just because that seemed like a pet project that he was working on, or at least initially.
Well, he also, you know, he would spend his own, he spent his own money on Timepiece, the short film that he did. Basically, Jane said that Jim told him, told her that, you know, "I want to take this amount of money, I think it was like $40,000 or something, and I want to spend it on making a short film." And they had been working very hard making this money, and they were doing a lot of commercials, so they had the money. But Jim was not afraid to spend the money on work that he was doing. The Dark Crystal, lend his own money at first.
Yeah, that's what I
You
kind of
know,
thought.
this was being done, yeah. Lord Grade, his company, financed this. And the story goes that after it was done, Jim screened it for all the executives at Lord Grade's company, and nobody quite got it. And Jim felt that if they weren't really behind it, he didn't want them involved. And you know, he wrote a check. He bought the film from Lord Grade at that point. And that's why, if you watch the movie and a copyright notice under the title, it's copyright Henson Associates and James M. Henson, not just Henson Associates, because he
Interesting.
used his personal money. It wasn't a corporate transaction.
I think I kind of
And I
knew that,
thought
but
that's, you
that
know, a real
confirms
demonstration
it,
of that's how much he believed in this. And
so.
what's amazing is that it, you know, it's a beautiful film, but so much before its time, you
Yeah.
know. And that's, you know, you look at it now, it has you know, and Dark Crystal did well at when it came out. Labyrinth did not do as well. It nowhere near the following that it has now, especially with the Netflix follow-up series and all of that. But you know, I think Jim showed how much faith he had in his work and the work of all the people that he worked with, and Brian Froud and Frank Oz, who co-directed with him. You know, he had faith in his work and the work of his collaborators.
Do you think now, and this would be purely speculative, but you were there, so that's why I'm asking. Had Henson lived 10, 20, 30 more years, would he have continued down that road with kind of more realistic Muppet, kind of along the lines of a Yoda from Empire Strikes Back and the Storyteller series and things like that? Or would he have eventually done what the Muppet Company eventually did, which is return to the Muppet Show Muppets time and again?
I think he would have done both, because if he had survived and if the Henson Disney deal had gone through the way it was, Jim was going to be making all manner of stuff for Disney. That was his plan, and I think he wanted to do all sorts of things. I mean, he was very interested in computer animation. He had done early Waldo C. Graphic character for Disney World, and for originally for the Jim Henson Hour, and he was fascinated in how live performance could interface with digital creation, and that's something that his son Brian helped w work to develop with the Henson Creature Shop. That's why they created the Henson Digital Performance System that they use on, you know, Sid the Science Kid and Splash and Bubbles and all the shows that they produce. But I think Jim would have really, you know, he would have gone back and forth, because he always loves, you know, getting together with everybody to do the Muppet stuff, you know. And that's what he was doing, near the end of his life. He would go from doing storyteller, oh, now we're going to do the Muppet Family Christmas, and then we're going to do this. And,
Right.
yeah.
It just seemed, as a fan at the time, it just seemed like there's almost a little bit of a disdain to it. Like, oh, do I have to do another one of these things? But, ironically, I think the last thing he did was the Muppet Vision 3D for Disney World, right? Was that the last
Well,
Muppet
that well, I
project,
think
or?
that was the last thing that premiered. The last, I
Okay.
think, the last thing he did was the Muppets at Walt Disney World TV special,
Okay.
because that was shot just a few weeks before he passed.
But again, it the last project was the Muppet Show Muppets, so but so he had no real problem with those, because I always thought for a
No,
time
because
there he wanted to be taken more
it was a it's
seriously
an
too.
opportunity to have, I think he felt it was an opportunity to have fun with his friends. It's like, this is, you get these group of people and you get to go and record music, and they always had a lot of fun when they did the pre-records. And this was an opportunity, to get together and wiggle the dollies, as they say. And it's something where you, as opposed to something like Dark Crystal, it's a relatively simple process. You go into the studio, at the end of the day, you have whatever you shot, and it's done. And you don't have to go through all of this digital effects and post-production. And I think that there's something that performers find a little fun about, that there's very little between the performer and the audience. You're directly reaching the audience.
Now, over the years, I've done this podcast 6 years almost, and interviewed a couple different people that actually work for Henson as well. I was just wondering if you cross paths with them, just out of curiosity. One is Craig Yeo.
I worked with Craig Yeo and Henson in New York, yeah.
And just out of curiosity. And the other was BK or Bob K. Taylor.
The name I've come across, but I don't think I worked with him.
Okay. It might have been before your tenure there. Yeah, he created some mid-70s Muppets, like the Dr. Teeth and I forgot the name of the robot that was on Sesame Street,
Sam.
Sam. Yeah, that's right. I was gonna say Simon, but I go,
Yeah,
no,
that was a few years
it's right
before I
in
got there.
my
Yeah.
head. Sam. Anyway, they liked that name, didn't
That
they?
was a few years. I remember when I started working at Henson, I think it was Kirk Thatcher who told me, the golden age of any place is always 6 months before you get there.
I think with BK Taylor, because I interviewed, of course, he, if you're not familiar, he did a lot of work for various magazines, like Dynamite and Bananas for Scholastic, things like that, and Sick Magazine, which is like Mad Magazine. He did lots of different work, but he did a main tenure in the mid 70s, but then would come back every so often to do illustrations for books or other things like that. So,
Yeah, that's why I've seen the name all over the place.
yeah. Okay. Now, as far as yourself, and with this book, is there any other Muppet books in your future, or any other books in your future that you
I'm
can
glad you
disclose?
asked me that question. Yeah,
Okay.
there, I am actually doing a follow-up to the Sam and Friends book. The Henson people, the family and the Henson company, have given me an okay to select some of Jim Henson's scripts for Sam and Friends, and to publish a compilation. There are five scripts printed in the original book. So this one will include those five, but it'll also roughly have a total of about 60 scripts that I've transcribed from original scripts, and also compared against the recordings, if there is a recording. And then I put in my annotations and notes on anything that the reader may not know in terms of historical references that will help them understand and appreciate the scripts a little bit more. So I'm working on that right now, and that's I think going to be a fun thing, because it'll be mostly transcribed scripts, but I'll have some of the original handwritten scans and typewritten scans that'll be sort of accentuating things throughout the book.
Now, I don't know this. I mean, are audio these audio recordings, or even the 15 or so video recordings, are those accessible, or are they kind of just lost in archives right now?
There are a couple of things that are out on YouTube in terms of the visual. The Henson company has released a few things on their official YouTube channel. The audio recordings are not available. I've had some discussions with Henson and see if if there's a way we can create some sort of album or audio production. And there's a lot of a lot of legal issues surrounding them because so many of them involve music recordings and records. And I think I would love for there to be some sort of way to get them out there. But I think if years ago, we'd have a easier time of trying to release an audio project into the world and on a packaged CD or I think the best shot is actually doing vinyl, which is kind of ironic.
Although I was thinking, for
But
you, the purposes of your book, if you're having like a script and you have the audio there, one way that you might go about it is to like print a little QR code that if you just scanned it, you could hear the audio that goes with that script, you know?
I would love to do that. I think that you know what? We'll continue to have discussions. I think there's stuff that's just too good to just sit in a vault and not be heard.
Because I mean, as me as a
But
fan, you know, I love reading scripts, but you know, to have it come alive where you actually hear Jim's voice and stuff like that, you know, that's the thing
yeah,
that that's the sweet
we have
spot for
not
me.
given up on it, but there are no official plans on that. And then I'm also working on a non-Muppet book. I'm working on a book about Jack Benny's guest appearances on television. I'm a big Jack Benny fan, and it just
Me
seems
too.
like I can do a book and not have to feel bad about spending all my time watching Jack Benny. It's like it's research.
Right. So is it him like being a panel guest on Tonight's Show, and or is it also acting appearances
Everything
like on
from
Lucy's Show? So it's everything. Okay. And even
yeah.
the
Everything.
Dick
He
Dean Martin roast and
did
all that
serious
stuff.
acting. Yep, did mean. Yep, he did Dean Martin roast. He did serious acting on anthology shows. He did What's My Line? He did Password. Did the Smothers Brothers. Everything you can imagine. So it's sort of a survey of all of that and trying to include. As exhaustive, and it is exhausting, as exhaustive a compilation list of all of his guest appearances over the years. That'll be an appendix.
I love books
But
like that.
I've started researching that.
I don't know if you know Wesley Hyatt, but he did a similar,
I've seen his books, yeah.
Bob Hope book and Red Skelton book and a Betty White book. So, you know, similar type things. I love those type of books.
Yeah,
So I'll
so
be.
this will, as with the Sam and Friends book and the script book, the Jack Benny book will also be published by Bear Manor Media, which publishes all manner of obscure entertainment topics.
Including most of mine. So, all right. Let's see. Well, I want to thank you, Craig Shimon, for being my special guest.
I feel special for being a special guest.
I'm glad that you did a Sam and Friends book, because that's, like I said, like the one big hole in my Muppet knowledge that was a big gaping
Well,
hole, and
you would
now
not
it's
be alone. There wasn't a lot up, up until now. There really wasn't a lot to learn about it. We didn't know a lot, so I feel really proud to be able to tell this story, not just on for Jim, but for Jane. Sadly, I almost had I had to wait until she was no longer with us to tell this story because she would have been quite embarrassed. She used to say, I was just a helper. I really didn't have anything to do with it. And then the more research I did, it's like, I don't think Jim would make a helper a 40% partner in the corporation.
I'm surprised how prominent a
So,
role she had. I didn't even really know that. I thought she was just kind of
well, and
in the
she really
background. I
went
mean,
out of her
really in the
way.
background, you know.
She went out of her way to stay in the background. You know, she really didn't want credit for anything. We sort of had to, twist her arm when people wanted to acknowledge her role in all of this.
So for this book, I know you've done a few other different shows, including Stu's show and things like that. So any other promotional opportunities or any other shows you're going to show up to in the next few months or anything like that?
Nothing planned, but I am available. So if you're
Okay.
out there,
All right.
no, I've been lucky enough to take this story all over the place. And I did a thing a couple of months ago at the Center for Puppetry Arts, and did it something at the Smithsonian. We've done something at the Museum of the Moving Image, and the University of Connecticut, the Ballard Institute of Puppetry up there. So, yeah, I'm happy to take this story all over.
All right.
But if people want, if you can find the book at bearmannermedia.com or amazon.com or Barnes and Noble, find Mark's book.
And if they want to reach out to you, if they have a question, is there a good way to contact you?
Yeah, you can reach me through my website, craigshemin.com, or samandfriendsbook.com. And while supplies last, if you do get the book and go to samandfriendsbook.com, and you can send an email through that website and request a autographed book plate and bookmark and little mini postcard and a special password, so you can go onto the samandfriendsbook.com website and see some of the pictures that are in my book in black and white. We posted the color versions online
Okay. All
because
right. I will
we
definitely
couldn't
take a look.
publish them in black and white, or
All
couldn't
right.
publish them in color.
Right. I get it. Although on the cover you have a nice color photo, which is nice. I mean, they'll hold it up just because I'm
Yes, and that,
cutting it off here,
the
you know.
color photos on the photo of Jim on the front and Jim and Jane on the back, those are like the only two color photos of big group shots of Jim and or Jane with the Muppets. So we're very fortunate that those existed.
Okay.
And
All
I'm also, I wanted to just thank Karen Falk again at the Henson Archives
right.
and all of the Henson family for being so supportive of this book, because they made this happen. They opened up the archive and made everything available for the book, because they wanted this story to be told. So I thank Lisa and Brian and Cheryl and Heather and everybody, Nicole Goldman at the Henson Company, and everyone at Disney as well, because Kermit is owned by Disney. So for him to appear anywhere, Disney had to grant permission. So I thank
That's very
everyone
cool.
at
Didn't even think
Muppet
about
Studio
that.
and Disney. Yeah. A
Well,
lot of
I'm going
people
to
had
thank
to
you
be
all
very,
too
very
because it made it a
generous.
better book. Yeah. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. It would have been very bad if I had to do this book and not use any pictures of Kermit. It would have been a lot of little blacked out things throughout. But everybody was really, really supportive, and Frank Oz, of course, who wrote the foreword, and I thank Frank for being so generous. I emailed him expecting that I would have to really beg and plead, and within 2 hours he wrote back. It's like, hey, I'll do it, no problem. And I'm
Very
like,
cool.
but I
Yeah.
had this whole argument getting set up for it.
No,
But yeah,
that's
so
great.
I so appreciate everyone who made this possible.
All right. And we're looking forward to that next Muppet book and your Jack Benny book. So, all right.
Thank you.
So,
Oh, I do
thank.
want to, before I
Oh,
sign off,
one
I
more.
do want to
Okay, that's
mention
fine.
two other people that worked tirelessly on this book, besides Ben Omart at Bear Manor. But my sister-in-law, Diana DiBruzzo, did a lot of copy editing, and my wife, Stephanie DiBruzzo, who was the first eyes on all of this manuscript. And, she also had a great point of view, because she is a professional puppeteer. So she was
Wow.
able to read the chapter where I'm describing the technical stuff, and she's like, no, there's better ways to put this.
That's cool.
And she helped me.
All right.
So I've thanked everyone. I
All
thank
right.
you now.
Okay, thank you. And I will thank you, Craig Shaman, for being my special guest. When your next books come out, I want to do a Jack Benny show. Maybe I'll wait till your show, till your book is done to have you back on the show and we can discuss all that. So, Again, I want to thank you again. And that's another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. This is your host, Mark Arnold, and we will see you next time.